The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
This is the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Podcast. What you just heard is Sand in My Diaper by Greg Chang. It's an incredible song. I think a lot of us can relate to it. And maybe if you've got sand in your diaper, today's podcast might be the menthol balm you're looking for. Zen Master, I'm calling him that. He doesn't call himself that. Someone has to call him that. Yoshin David Raiden is here with us today. We're going to jump right into it, but first this.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
And we're back. My loves, won't you subscribe to my Patreon? Are you sick of commercials? You want commercial-free episodes? You want to hang out with me twice a week? We've got a weekly meditation group. We've got our family gathering. We are writing a book together, and we create together, and all we need is you, your sweet, beautiful eyes, and your face, and your feet, and your elbows. That's it. Patreon.com/DTFH, deliver yourself to us. We will do the rest. Also, come see me live. I'm going to be at Cobb's Comedy Club in San Francisco. That's if you're listening to this on the week of September 21st. If you're not listening to this on the week of September 21st, maybe by the time you listen to this, time machines will exist and you can come see the show. I'm going to be in Salt Lake City the week after. All the other dates, you can find them at DuncanTrussell.com. I'd love for you to come see me live. And now with us is, holy God in heaven, who is this person? I don't know how I get to talk to people like this. His name, Yoshin David Raiden. He is a teacher at Ithaca Zen Center, and he blew my mind during this conversation. If you aren't familiar with Zen, then this is the introduction you deserve. He is a beautiful, brilliant human, and I really hope you will check out his new book. It's called A Temporary Affair, Talks on Awakening and Zen. This is a collection of Dharma talks that he gave at the Ithaca Zen Center as he was undergoing kidney failure. Fortunately for all of us, he got a new kidney. One of his students gave it to him. And so now we have him in this particular swath of the multiverse. If you like him, definitely order his book. That's A Temporary Affair, Talks on Awakening and Zen. And also, if you're interested, he gives weekly talks at the Ithaca Zen Center. You can go to IthacaZenCenter.org to find him and find the schedule. Now, everybody, here we go. Let's dive in to nothingness and everythingness. Welcome to the DTFH, Yoshin David Radin. Yoshin, welcome to the DTFH. It's a real pleasure to meet you.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Wow, you have been through a lot. How are you feeling? How are the kidneys treating you?
Yeah, I feel really well. Yeah, everything's worked out. And the ordeal wasn't really all that much.
Do you ever wonder to yourself if somehow your life had, if your karma, whatever you want to call it, hadn't led you to Zen? What do you think the experience of having kidney failure would have been like compared to what it was like from a lifetime of study?
Having happened the way it did, I'm not permitted to reflect on those things.
Oh. Cool. That's awesome.
I will if you want.
Oh, I would love it. Yes, I would love it.
I would have had to wait to stumble into something else that told me that it is indeed impermanent. The physical stay here. It just depends when you meet it. It's inevitable to meet it because it's inevitable to die. So at some point you're going to get something that says, yeah, that's true. And then you have to decide whether you're going to just ignore it or try to understand it and integrate it.
Had you in your life prior to this encountered that reality? Like, did you make it this far? Kind of incredible that you made it this far without some physical something popping up that rang the bell.
So when you say, you know, kidney failure wasn't the first introduction for me, there were many events way before.
Okay.
I had 50 years of since the first time, you know, something pointed me in that direction.
Yeah, I really, no matter how much I meditate, I still really don't want to die. And anytime I brush up against that, and even though it's in all of the everything, remember, you're going to die. You're definitely going to die. I mean, depending on what scripture, it's some of an entire poem could be, you're going to die. You know you're going to die, right? What are you doing? You're going to die. You will definitely die. Something about brushing up against that. I mean, it's obviously it's generally more poetic and coming from an enlightened mind, but wow. Anytime I really brush up against that via some contemplation, a doctor visit, it is the worst thing I can think of. It's still, oh. Is it like that for you?
Either a circumstance will happen that forces the issue. In other words, suppose you get into a car crash and you don't know if you're going to survive it.
Right.
So then what you'd rather experience or not experience is moot.
Yeah.
It's right there in front of you.
Right.
Or if you meet somebody who you trust more than you trust your own mind, that would be a spiritual teacher. When you are willing to accept somebody's intelligence as a replacement for your own.
Wow. Okay, that sounds a little worse than death, the second part.
Well, let's describe it differently then. You fall in love with the teacher. You fall in love with someone who's finally has the capacity to have it all make sense. Yeah, and it's really an evolutionary thing. It's not controlled by your will.
I love reading Buddhist scriptures, stories. I'm taken by the foreword in all of these that I've been looking at. Shantideva, Way of the Bodhisattva. Many of them, I can't remember the... These are Vajrayana, Tibetan Zen. But I'm taken by the general, in the beginning, the author will say, you know, I have a clumsy mind. I'm not enlightened. And then they're considered to be the examples, a watermark, someone you would want to replace your mind with. Have you ever met anyone who just said, I'm enlightened. I'm actually enlightened. I'm enlightened. Who didn't have that beginning thing of like, oh no, I'm not even close.
to be an I, okay, to be an individual makes enlightenment impossible. There'll never be such a thing. There never has ever been an enlightened individual. Enlightenment.
Even the Buddha?
Worst of all.
Even worse? It just keeps getting worse. We gotta die quick.
No. I'm just playing. You know, even the Buddha would say you shouldn't mistake the finger pointing at the moon for the moon. Yeah, so even if somebody's enlightened, he may not be of any use. Enlightened means enlightened. We can use, you know, tentatively use enlightened as someone who's passed through the fear of death. Someone who has died and come back, or near death, come back and seen that there is an essence within us beyond the death of the individuality. And that person gives a testimony, so to speak. Yeah, that person will teach the gospel or the sutras, which is an attempt to describe what the transcendence of death looks like. But words can't catch it at all. So, you know, it's not good to try to figure it out, because the thinking mind cannot approach. It has to be the dissolution of the mind that is identifying itself as a body. And then that mind will suddenly realize, I am the mind. I actually am the same I. I am the eternally existing one. But the individuality was just a mistaken functioning of the mind. That I existed as an individual took place only because the mind thought that the body was itself. And therefore, that mind that's thinking the body is the identity can never attain enlightenment, because that very mind has to grow quiet or dissolve. Yeah.
Bad news for the mind.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
What you're saying, I have read, which is essentially the you that wants to get enlightened will not be the you that gets enlightened. So it's a paradoxical desire born of...
Not quite right.
Oh, good.
The you that asks the question is the you that will become enlightened.
Whoa.
But it will stop, it'll have stopped wearing a garment that was identifying as itself, and it will see itself face to face. It will know, here I am. I am the truth. I am the way. None cometh to enlightenment but through me. It will know that instead of knowing itself with the garment, I am the body. I am David. The same mind, always same mind.
So is this an issue of circumference? Is this an issue of just the circumference of identity naturally gets wrapped up in the body, and within that, all of this suffering happens because you have to defend the body, feed the body, make the body look pretty, and do all the things, and it's all the suffering. So if that circumference either is eliminated or even expanded, then you would expect whatever it was you thought you were to change with that expansion.
Right. But the depth into which the ignorance has settled in the mind makes it very difficult. Very difficult. ever since you appeared in this world, from the very first moment you appeared in this world, you were told that you had a name and a body. That's the first thing you ever learned. So the mind is building a structure based on an assumption that it takes to be a reality and not a misinformation or a mistaken.
It's a lot of programming, a lot of coding.
Yeah, and therefore, and since it is so deep in the mind, the loss of that thought is the fear of death. It's the same thing. As soon as you received a name and an identity, you were also implanted with the fear of death. That's natural, inevitable. That's why it's so deep. That's why, you know, very difficult.
Is it, I mean, I'm sorry if this seems like a softball question, but is it kind of hopeless? I mean, this thing you're talking about, isn't it just in this... That thing you're talking about, doesn't it go beyond just somebody gave you a name and told you what a good boy and a bad boy is and you went into the world and all that stuff? Isn't it somehow much deeper than even that? Like, we're talking, you know, when you see those depressing videos of landfills where they're just like, you know, compressing garbage on top of garbage on top of garbage. Isn't it more like that?
Yeah, probably worse. I mean, you know, for those of us who were raised in the West, especially going back to my childhood in the 40s, 50s, there wasn't even a fragrance of these teachings out there. Nothing. There was nothing for me. And I went to parochial schools. You'd think it would have some smattering of spirituality, but it had none. And it wasn't until my psyche was threatened during drugs usage. That the need to see into the nature of the mind became the primary activity of my life. But God, if I don't know what I knew in that moment, then I'm going to waste my life on futile activities. So that kind of experience happened to me in early 20s. And then, you know, things followed after that. I played Hansel and Gretel, pick up the breadcrumbs. Kind of like that.
I mean, you really found some great crumbs.
Good teachers.
But you're a renowned teacher of what I consider to be, of all the forms of Buddhism, the most frustrating and confusing, and most of them are frustrating and confusing to some degree, but Zen, wow, it's just so simple. Yes?
Suppose you met a beautiful woman. I'm assuming that's the gender you prefer to be intimate.
Yeah. Okay. I'm married, I got kids.
Oh, okay. So suppose you meet a beautiful woman and she looks back at you with some inviting glance or open glance. You approach her just looking at each other. Effortless activity. You wouldn't have to read a book. What do I do next? You wouldn't have to read a book. Gee, where's this? What did Plato say about it? Hi. Yeah.
Yeah. And
that's how it is when you see it. It's not, you could have read 1,000 books on Vajrayana, Hinayana, Mahayana, Zen, it will have nothing to do with anything.
No. Yeah. Yeah, like those are all just sort of romance, but I mean, you know, you can read 1,000 romance books, but until you have experienced what is the core of the...
Let me share with you an old friend of mine, younger, you know, he was a kind of peripheral student of mine. He's probably now upper 30s, 40. So he was driving down the highway and there was a huge pileup. He was in a 5-car collision. Part of it was a trip, 18-wheeler and things. And he was right smack in the middle of the 5 cars. His car was crushed. And when he opened his eyes, his bones were sticking out through his skin. And he had lost all of his flesh on one side of the body. And they told him that they wouldn't be able to get him out for an hour. So he was in huge, huge pain. And then, because we spoke together afterwards, he had remembered a teaching that said, when you have physical pain, move towards it, not away from it. Okay, so that's what came to him. And he might have heard it as a sentence once long ago. But he moved towards the pain of his body being in this unbearable pain. Yeah, so he moved towards it. And he said as soon as he moved towards it, he was catapulted out of the body and was sitting on the roof of the car looking at his body in that position. And then the pain came back so bad that he was, and so he had to go back into breathing himself into, and then again catapulted out. And he was making that circle for an hour. And he wrote to me, he can't believe how fortunate he was to have that experience. He said, before that happened, No one could have given me $1 billion to go through that experience. And now that I went through it, even if somebody offered me $1 billion for that experience not to happen, I wouldn't take it. Because now I saw the whole thing clearly. Now I saw the nature of reality. I saw where I go to after death. I saw there was the death of the body was not the death of the self. I saw it all. And he was just crying in joy. But $1 billion he would have paid not to have to go through that, because the pain was so intense. That was just a few weeks ago, a few months.
How's he doing now? Is he better?
He's living out in Santa Cruz surfing.
Wow.
We put him back together in 4 months. He was walking around.
What about effortlessness? Effortlessness. Why is that, at least from the outside, why does that seem frustrating to some people, this effortlessness that you're talking about? Why does that upset people?
People are addicted to solving problems through thinking. And then when you have a practice that's designed to dissolve, to relax the thinking activity, let's just say it. Thinking can't believe it. It doesn't know how to do it. I can't do it. So it's very frustrating. People cannot meditate. People are that which makes meditation impossible.
Hmm. You mean not that people can't meditate, but the being a person makes meditation impossible.
Correct.
And so when, as a person, you sit down on the cushion.
Yes.
You're doing something impossible.
Correct. Impossible impossible for what you take yourself to be. It's the calming of the mental conversation. And you can't calm it through activity. Yeah, you can make certain gestures, you know, count the breathing, breathe out through your left nostril. Pull your belly in, push it out. But none of that will awaken you. The awakening is actually the simplest thing that you can do. It's not a complicated thinking activity. Thinking is what people rely on, and the nature of thinking is suffering. It is not that thinking can cause suffering. Thinking is suffering. So you're using a vehicle that is suffering to try to find the way out of suffering. And that can't be done.
Is happiness a flavor of suffering?
That's my wife. Suffering is a form of happiness. Only if you're very happy when you suffer.
Yeah. I mean, the two, the that's great. I'm curious about the, if there is a connection between the awakened mind and the thinking mind, in the sense, sort of like, even if it's, you know, in reverse, like the idea that if I see a thing and then I turn it into its, I think of its opposite, or if, and maybe this is impossible because you're saying you're not going to think your way out of this, but I'm, or, well, you shall know the Father by the Son. So can from the even the most sort of annoying, intrusive, meaningless thought, is there some possibility of extrapolating from that the awakened mind?
Yeah, I suppose. It's not something that you lack and then you suddenly discover you have. It's something that you are from the beginning. How do you realize what you are, what you originally were? Sometimes it's called the original phase. How do you realize your original phase? There is no way. It just... it's not hard. Look, when you're sitting on the cushion, okay? Imagine you're sitting on a meditation cushion and you're breathing, okay? And you're aware of the breathing. That which is aware of the breathing is the awakened mind. It's not complicated. Mm. When you are walking, and you are aware that you're walking, that awareness is the Buddha mind. It is the original nature of mind. The mind falls into the I am walking being the body, not I am the awareness of the walking body. It's starting to make a separation between the body and the witness of the body, which is not a spatial separation. It's
no separation. See,
what makes separation
right.
is thinking.
Right.
But then the mind arrives, you know, body and mind then have to be recognized based on this new information. In other words, the mind, the thinking, the one who's pursuing the wisdom insight, okay, the one who's pursuing it, wait a second, I have been calling myself a body, but now that I've been practicing, and I realize that I am that which experiences the breathing, and the breathing is an object I am experiencing, clear as daylight, the same way you see a tree, you see a breathing. The mind is starting to recalibrate now. So wait a second, how does this all work? My nature is the awareness. So what's the body doing now? What happens to the body? Before it was myself. Now wait a second, it's an object that I'm looking at. So recalibrating that is, that's what fills up sutras.
Recalibrating, not the, okay, that makes a lot of sense. When you caught a glimpse of this in a yeah. stable way, did you yeah. kind of feel like not talking about it, or did you feel shy? Did you feel shy about it, or a sense of like, oh, I don't want to say anything, I don't want to, jinx it or something, or
yeah, that's why people talk about how important silence is, because it's only in the silence that you awaken and become aware of the awareness. The awareness becomes aware of itself. If talking is going on, even some degree of thinking is going on, then the awareness gets lost in the objects it is experiencing. So in order for it to see clearly, then there needs to be some level of silence.
So theoretically, there are countless people out there who have had this simple yet somehow unattainable or rare encounter. Right. And have just chosen to not talk about it for their whole lives, maybe, just never yeah. say a thing.
Yeah. Until they got a good offer from YouTube.
until he started podcast.
No, I mean, even if you have the vision, even if you have it, it gets covered over. It's covered over. So you have to learn, you know, even after you have the experience, you need to learn, like, how do I function in this world now knowing this? How do I function? And that's also sort of part of the journey.
I'm interested in this, anyone who's on the, you know, whatever you want to call it, anyone who gets caught by this stuff, there is a great deal of writing about, and I'm so happy it's there, about your practice. You know, here's a form, and here's how you might sit. Here's where you rest your attention. But after the glimpse or whatever you might call it, I really can't bring to mind specific instructions of like, now this is how you calibrate, as you said, or
that would be a mistake. That would be a mistake. Because once you start conceptualizing the experience, then it's not the experience anymore. So as long as you're there, you cannot have the experience in its fullness. That's why all teachers had retreat times. There were times when you have a retreat where you set up a situation where silence and there's no need for thinking. The fundamental nature of a retreat environment is there's no need for thinking, so that you can rest the mind. But really, when you live out everyday life, it's better to just be simple, be gentle, be kind, be forgiving. You never want to hurt your mind, because you realize your mind is God incarnated. That is how God incarnates, through the human mind or through the mind. And so you should treat the mind as divine. You would never treat something that you love and honor in a way beyond anything humanly imaginable. There is no way you would want to let anger into that environment. There's no way you would like to have aggression come into that environment. There's no way that you would do anything that would pollute the psychological state. I mean, what did teachers say? You know, love thy neighbor as thyself. Be a peacemaker. They're the children of God. The meek shall inherit the earth. This is telling you how to function before and after. Before, you can't even do that. Well, I can love everybody, but him, no.
Right. No.
Yeah, so before and after, those things apply. Those would be the guides to how to live. Not remembering the experience and trying to reproduce it, because you can't reproduce it out of the past. It's the essence of the present moment. So there's no climbing in through some back stairway.
I'm going to find one. I've heard there's one.
My way into the attic through the back staircase.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
With a $5 meal deal with new McValue. You pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
But let's talk a little bit more about this landfill situation. Is the landfill God? I mean, is the, you know, that,
yes, you know, and no. You,
please elaborate.
Okay, when you have a dream at night, okay, are you the dream or are you not the dream? The entirety of the dream or not?
Both. I would say, I mean, in the sense
that's
that.
That's the answer. Yes and no. The mind essence never incarnates, but when God manifests, it manifests as the oneness of all appearances. In other words, the dream doesn't have separate souls in it. There's only one source of existence of the characters in the dream. That source is the dreaming mind. And when you see that the seat in the waking state, the existence doesn't sit inside the body. Okay, so now I'm going to say something that you might want me to explain. But what's actually sitting inside the body is the entire universe.
Yes, I would love for you to explain that.
Okay, when you hear a bird, okay, where do you, what are you actually hearing?
Sound waves.
You're actually hearing the vibrations of a sense organ of the body, correct?
Correct.
What you are hearing is the vibration of the eardrum that gets transmitted through a very complex structure, and then a bird song appears. So what created the bird song? The human body appeared as the bird song.
That is, yeah, I see what you're
saying.
When
you see a tree, yeah?
Yeah.
What are you seeing? What you're actually seeing is your retina. The body creates the tree. The body and the tree are not separate. The only reason that you think that the tree is over there and you are in here is because thinking has inserted a self inside the body and claims that it is doing the seeing, but it's not doing the seeing. You don't see the tree.
You know, when you say things like that, do you know these days what you're supposed to say before it? Spoiler alert. So people know you're about to wrecking ball their entire reality.
It's a love note.
Oh, I know. Don't
be afraid of the dissolution. Start to develop a fondness for fear. Start to develop a fondness for corpses. Start to develop a fondness. Turn your mind around. Fear is the invitation to the transcendent. It's the ego's last stand. The last ditch effort of the mind that's calling itself the body to prevent you from exposing its non-existence. And so start whenever you find fear in your life, whenever you find fear, stop and honor it and be there with it. Do not want it to go away. It's the wanting of fear not to be present that what empowers the fear experience. That makes it more and more dominant, impossible to deal with. So any time that comes into your mind, a fearful moment, breathe. Don't try to resolve it in thinking or in emotion. Try to dissolve, try to use awareness, be aware of its existence and aware of the breathing, and that you're going to stand empty and non-reactive behind with the breathing and experiencing the nature of experiencing fear itself. That's how we start to approach or prepare. It's one of the practices. That's why in the old days, people, part of the practices would be to go meditate in cemeteries and things like that. But you don't have to do that. Anytime fear appears, don't regard it as something you want not to happen.
What is the difference between fear and bliss? Is there a difference? Is fear just some, like if we're, you know, if we're some kind of synthesizer of possible experiences, fear just a key, as you're saying, just running through the same circuit board? In other words, if you start, as you are instructing, being with a fear, not running away from the encounter with it, and then spending time with it, is there some possibility that you begin to realize it wasn't even fear? That's not fear. That's bliss or joy or some other thing altogether.
Yeah. Well, you're married.
Yes.
Yes.
Fear and bliss are the same. But let's talk about it a little bit differently.
Okay.
The joy is the moment the mind realizes that it can handle it. Never thought it could handle it. It always was panicked and run away.
Yes.
You've decided, okay, have me, fear. You can take over my mind. I am not leaving or turning you away. And then the mind will be there in this intensity of fear. And then it will gradually, the intensity will start to fade. And it'll become more wordy than energy. And then the mind will realize, I have nothing to fear but fear itself. I don't need to fear fear. It's one of the famous practices of the path, making friends with fear. Making friends with all negative emotions.
When you make friends with fear, is it still fear?
As one might say, oy vey. You know, it's what it is. I can't tell you. Fear is a name. Fear is the name that the mind puts on an energy. But fear is never fear. Fear is always intensity. It is an unbearable intensity. And so we call it fear because we put names on everything. We put a word love on something. Does that word love have anything to do with the actual experience of being in love? No, it's not. So you can't, fear is better to describe as intensity. Yeah, and usually fear can be described as the desire not to have this experience under any circumstances. Is that a definition? Never.
Yes. So, yes.
And then you suddenly realize that that's not true. That you are capable of having that experience. But in order to do that, you have to be very, very open and still you know, yeah, really, in truth, for that practice to be totally accomplished, you have to, if you want to get your, you know, spiritual student of the month award.
I do. I would love one.
Then it's even in the face of loss of life. Like my friend, you know, who would want to go through an experience like that? But then having beheld that he had a nature that was untouched by what was going on, was worth more than $1 billion of gold. It's just like, how much money would you pay to never have the fear of death?
Right.
How much? One of the lengthier times I had was with a kidney failure situation. So there were times when it got a little bit more acute than it was supposed to, because my daughter was going to donate a kidney. And so the doctors didn't want to put me on dialysis because the transplant was so close. So they were walking on a fine line, because if your kidney fails beyond a certain point, then you have to have dialysis or you'll be dead. And they were pushing that line. I think when the surgery finally happened, I had something, I'm not 100%, but like 7-8% of kidney function left, 6% something. And then my daughter developed a urinary tract infection on the day that we were supposed to have the transplant, and that completely disqualified. And she had an incompatible protein. So another friend in the Zen Center said, here, let me do this. I would love to donate kidney. So it takes about, they put her on very fast track, like to try to, there are a lot of tests that a donor has to go through to make sure that it's okay.
Can't imagine.
And so they fast tracked it, but by the time, even the fast tracking before it got to clear her, I had crossed the line where I had to have dialysis. So they had to put in a temporary port to do dialysis. And sometimes it reached really challenging moments, you know, trips to the emergency room because of the kidney failure and blood pressure, and heart condition. So there was all this stuff going on that had an element, had a potential for fear in it. But I never experienced fear. And it was so surprising to me. I was laughing because I thought how powerful the Dharma teachings are, how incredible the wisdom is. And you can go into the emergency room with people, and you're just completely unbothered. So that to me was a very powerful affirmation of the Dharma teaching, the Dharma wisdom, truth. You know?
Yes.
So that was okay. That was that. And then the kidney transplant worked well. And so now my health is, you know, pretty good. That was 3 years, 3.5 years, three and a half years ago. So these, I never wrote a book, you know, this book, it's a book of talks that Rick was recording. And I was just giving talks to the community.
I have one question.
I've never written anything like that.
I wanted to ask you about your talks. I was curious only because, and I think maybe this is just stuff you hear, I don't know, but how much do you prepare for your talks? When you go to give a talk, do you have a set plan, or are you purely spontaneously sort of emanating from that place?
I feel like my whole life is a preparation to give a talk. So I never talk from a text. It's like, okay, today we're going to study the Diamond Sutra. No, it's too dry for me. It's not alive. You know, it's like, I don't know, darling, I want to kiss you. Let's put our masks on. You wouldn't do it.
That's beautiful.
I'd rather have COVID than kiss you with a mask. Quick, let's go get tested. Let's strike while the iron is hot.
I have swabs.
Are we allowed to be this silly, or is this going to ruin the whole thing?
This is the best.
Yeah.
What were we talking about?
I just am so happy.
Oh, you prepare for talks.
Yeah, preparing for talks.
You know, essentially, when I give talks, and these talks especially, because these talks were given in the proximity of, you know, fifth stage kidney failure.
Yes.
You know, so end stage renal failure. So at that time, I thought, well, I can just share with the community, you know, this is what it's like to have end stage renal failure in light of the wisdom of self not being defined by the body as its identity. So I would just talk about that from different angles, mostly, or different things like that. No, I never, I think in the book, in the book, Rick, who recorded all these talks, wrote the preface, and he was saying how he was surprised that I never seemed to show up with notes.
Yes. No.
But I don't need to have notes to talk with you. And that talking to my students is like talking to you.
Wow.
Suppose I said to you, you know, I don't know what, but suppose you had a question and I said, well, wait a second, let me look it up. That would be ridiculous.
Yeah, I didn't think of that. You're right. No, I'm asking that not just because of how, you know, from the outside, it's impressive to be able to do that. But I'm also curious regarding sort of the, Dharma is frequency. In other words, as you said, so someone gains realization and then when they're talking, it's the Dharma. It's this coming out of them. So I'm, you know, you see those beautiful sand mandalas that the Tibetans do and they throw them in the river. And sometimes I look at that and I'm thinking, I don't know if they memorize that. I feel like they're just doing it, that it's just coming out of them. Is that BS? Is that not real? Or is this a memorized thing? But also when someone like you begins speaking, as you said, there's no notes. And yet, you know, it's, okay, you're checking off all of these, it's answering questions. It's sort of helping you align bits of a puzzle that have been scattered all over your table. So I guess I'm, is it that you're sort of like a radio now? In other words, like you're tuning in this thing that is this omnipresent sort of reality, truth. And then when you start talking, that's what comes out. Not to say it would always be truth that comes out of your mouth. It wouldn't surprise me. But I guess, is it, where is it? Are we talking about some cosmic radio signal? What is this thing?
Suppose you walk into the Louvre?
Yeah.
Is that where Mona Lisa lives?
That's the Louvre.
You go into the Louvre and you're looking at Mona Lisa, okay? And then someone says to you, can you describe the Mona Lisa for me? And then you say, well, don't look, use a book. Describe the Mona Lisa because you see it.
Yeah.
So once you've seen it, you're just describing what you saw. Not describing, it's not like you're reading a text that you took notes on what you saw. Not coming from the notes of what you saw. It comes from the actual seeing.
Yeah.
Well, if I go in, I say, I never know what I'm going to talk about, but usually I see people sitting in front of me. It depends on, it just depends on the situation. Most people are helped most 90-95% people are helped more by a teaching that says never respond aggressively when something hurts you. 95% of people will get more benefit from a teaching like that than they will from the self nature that resides outside the human body mind, not inside. That teaching. So there's a whole collection of teachings, you know, how to prevent the mind from what it considers justified negativity. In other words, if somebody does something outrageous to you, an aggressive response appears to be natural. If I don't respond this way, I'm being hypocritical and insincere, and all that. So mind will be making arguments to produce negativity.
100%.
And to go against that, to put up, you know, to realize that the quality of my life is going to be what I do at this moment. If I respond with anger, that's my making my life angry. It's a horrible experience. So
yes,
therefore,
I just,
you know,
thank you.
So therefore, I should cultivate an awareness of my emotional state, and when I see it, when my mind becomes painful, I should realize that's my responsibility. The quality of my mind should not be in the hands of external people or circumstances. The quality of my mind, I am protecting my mind from going into negative experiences, and the most powerful protection, that which enhances your ability to do that, is the willingness to lose.
This is problematic for me. You have described, if you mapped it out. Here's my fear. Especially these days, there's lots of talk, healthy boundary setting in a relationship, boundary setting with kids, boundary setting with everything, boundaries, boundaries, boundaries. And the encroachment upon these boundaries that you have set, generally healthy boundaries, you know, expectations that seem normal, you know, like, is it wrong that I want my wife and children to fully prostrate to me when I walk through the door? Come on, this is what I deserve. I want to bow, bells, incense. I can't get them to do that. they generally ignore me.
There is one way that you can get them to bow to you in gratitude. Oh. Ask for a divorce.
Ouch! A roast from a Zen master! A roast from a master! Ouch! Laughing so hard, it's got me crying over here.
I hope you have a good editor.
You think I'm going to edit that out? That's going on a highlight reel, friend. But I'm sorry for my lame joke, which was followed by a well-deserved roast. But you know what I mean? The healthy boundary setting. And within that, you know, if an argument emerges in most relationships, whether it's between countries or friends or husband and wife or brother, sister, usually there's some sense you've encroached upon this boundary and it's unacceptable. And I need to speak up for myself. And you need to apologize, or there should be some recognition of a misstep here. And that if one or the other decides to say, all right, fine, you can, what you did was fine, to lose, that over time, this behavior will result in a kind of oppression, the possibility of being so backed into a corner that you, there's no escape, and you're just sort of not who you were anymore. You're some kind of, a henchman or something, a non-autonomous henchman who's just like not fully being themselves. So how do we, in those situations, I mean, how do you, you know, with, not to like over-dramatize it, but we certainly with Hitler, I mean, thank goodness we weren't like, you know what, we're going to lose this one, you know? So can you simultaneously lose and win, or how do you maintain boundaries while sometimes allowing yourself to be wrong?
There is room for common sense in the human world. And if you have to take action based on compassion, that if you have to take action to avert a greater evil, you know, that you can do that. Suppose somebody's coming with a knife to kill somebody, you're capable of hitting that person with a car when you're driving. For an example, that would be a compassionate act. Hitler thing is so far downstream. It's so hypothetical for us to talk about it. But
sure,
people like to play the Hitler card.
So let's scratch it from the record. It's a hacky interview question. Scratch it from the record. Let's bring it down to earth. This didn't happen to me, but let's say you wake up. You make breakfast for the kids, but you weren't paying attention to the clock, and you didn't make breakfast in time. And let's say that your wife is like not happy because you weren't paying attention to the clock. You wanted to make biscuits for the kids, and you felt like saying, "Look, I was trying to make biscuits for the kids. Are you mad at me? Don't you see I was trying to make biscuits for the kids?"
Wrong. That's not what you say.
What do you say?
You say, "I'm sorry, I'm such a schmuck. I can't even keep track of time. I did the best I could, and I'm really sorry. I'm sorry I let you down, kids. Missed the school bus, now you gotta come late into class. Everybody's gonna make fun of you. I'm sorry."
You're right.
Think what the energy of the situation is when you say, "It was my fault. It was really, I just didn't pay attention. You know, I'm sorry. That's all I can tell you." And that'll create a certain environment. And you say, "I did the work, you know," think of the environment that leaves you in. you see.
Yes.
It's learning how to take care of the quality of the emotional situation rather than taking care of the circumstances. When your focus is only on the circumstances, then you want your performance to be acknowledged. But if you're focusing on what's going to make a harmonious environment to live in, then that's you take the blame. And then everybody feels better. Everybody knows you're sorry. You take the apology.
Yep.
I wrote, there was a time, probably about 7-8 years ago. I had some really skillful, a long story. You can delete out what you want of this story, but I had a friend who was a brilliant blues guitarist, and he was at this kind of health retreat that we sometimes have. A brilliant blues guitarist. And he didn't want to play rock or blues anymore. He only wanted to play flamenco. And he was a brilliant blues guitarist. He had a big heavy metal band in the 80s. And then he went into Zen and he thought flamenco's more spiritual. Something like that.
Wow.
Anyway, so I said to him, if I wrote you a blues song, would you write the music for it? And he said, you don't need to write a blues song for me to sing or play the blues. I'll play it. I said, no, I feel like writing a song. So I wrote a song that night. Long song. And it goes something like, the lyrics go something like, I got the runaway blues and you're tracking me down. I got the runaway blues and I know I've been found. I'm down on my knees, you can take me now. I will cut off my head if you just tell me how. And you smile, maybe shed a tear and say, that's what I've been waiting to hear. And you picked me up and you put me down. And it goes on to a point of how could I ever thought how happy I would be lying in the gutter. It's a long song. It's on a CD.
But contextually, it's amazing.
I started writing for a while.
Yes, I listened to some of your poems.
You're all about losing. Well, practice how to lose. That was one of the songs on that CD. Practice how to lose. Practice how to lose. Doesn't matter what you want or what you'd rather choose. That was the chorus. Practice how to lose. And then others, they're all about that as a way of life. The meek shall inherit the earth. You'll see that when you refuse to get into a struggle in any situation, and if you don't want to go along with the situation, you can just remain silent. Or if you have sufficient, if the situation is just right for a certain willful act, you can do it. But basically, you control the environment by your openness. And everybody else is struggling for a piece of the winning action.
Right.
You no longer are, because you've already won. You've won by the virtue of who you are. You don't win in the ego realm. There's no winning in the ego realm. Ego is a temporary, impermanent identity. Not an identity where you gain your victory and everybody applauds you, and then cancer won't bother you. It doesn't work that way.
This has been my favorite podcast, I think, ever. Thank you. You have truly just been so generous with your time. Thank you for this. And folks around you in Ithaca, if someone hears this, can they come see you give Dharma talks?
Yeah, I give Dharma talk every Sunday still. So, and then, like, yeah, we have retreats now, these health and physical and spiritual. They're called body-mind restoration retreats. Restores health of body and mind. And I give a talk each night.
And these are done live or via Zoom? I know you're at IthacaZenCenter.org.
Only live.
Wow.
Only live. And then, oh no, there's Zoom. Not those. Yeah. Sunday morning is Zoom.
So on Sunday morning, they can see you on Zoom. And are these also, is there meditation involved with the talks? Are you doing any online meditation with folks?
Most of the people who come to the Zoom lecture are sitting there with a coffee and a Danish.
That's awesome.
It's my impression. When I look into their eyes, I see nothing. But the people come, you know, and they get what they get. And sometimes you repeat something 100 times, and maybe one time something happens in life that affirms what you've been told. The Dharma protects you from the seductiveness of aggression, and you feel true. I think there's a scripture somewhere that says the happiest moment in the life of a yogi is when he lets go of an aggressive response, where before he knows he would have. The happiest moment of his life.
I get it. I get why that would be.
The spiritual world has different causes for happiness than the material world. Material world, happiness is pleasure and money. In the spiritual world, pleasure is a tranquil mind. And really, though I don't mean this in the wrong way, but it's the glory of God. The ultimate glory of God is that God, the pure consciousness, the Buddha mind, that it can bestow life on a human being. And that human really doesn't exist, but can think that he exists and as if he exists. It doesn't exist. Greatest glory of God. Create existent, non-existent creatures, apparently existent. All human beings are born from that function that the divine performs. It sends the Holy Spirit, so to speak, into the human mind. And the Blessed Virgin receives the Holy Spirit and starts to exist. All that's a metaphor for how it all takes place.
Wow. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a happy moment when you realize that even these totally screwed up scriptures have secret meanings in them.
Yes. Yes, it is. I know, it's exciting. It's also exciting to have someone like you to confirm certain intuitions with, you know. It's nice to bounce ideas around with someone like you. In fact, I sometimes feel like my podcast is some kind of trap for people like you, or somehow I get lucky enough to talk, to get an hour, over an hour to process things with you. It's I can't believe I get to do this.
Thank you.
No, me, thank you.
For me to be with someone who's interested in the Dharma, one of my happiest times.
Well, after this, you are going to get, many people are going to reach out to you because this is a mind-blowing conversation.
You know, two very close friends of mine we've done interviews with. They both wrote endorsements of the book that was published. Trudy Goodman and Jack Cornfield.
Yeah, I believe it. I mean, I can see how y'all are friends.
Yeah.
When anytime I get a chance to talk with him, I just feel really lucky. Yeah, I gotta stop being such a jerk, man. I'm so aggressive. I gotta stop. Oh, he's trying to win. Like, even when I think I'm not trying to win, I'm trying to win. It's under the surface. It's like very deep. It's not, I mean, like, I get what you're saying. Like, I can sort of stuff it down. But I know it's still present. It's still visible. It's like when you don't take a shower and you have BO and you try to put, you know, deodorant over your smell.
Dr. Bronner's.
Did you say Dr. Bronner's?
I was soaked.
Yeah. But you know, it's like.
And then they caught because there are bubbles coming out of your
arm. Foam. Yeah.
Foam.
That's, you know, but that is what, I mean, I do think that, like, or you know, when you have a cavity, you can brush your teeth. You can floss, but if you've got a rotten tooth, people can smell it. And this aggression you're talking about, an emanation of the landfill or something, even if I'm like, all right, I'm going to lose this time, I feel like somewhere in there is an air of it, a sense of it.
Little by little, though. Once, right. Just seeing the path is joyous. Maybe I can't walk it. I know I can't walk it yet. But I know what the path is now.
Right.
Now I know how to work with my mind to keep it. If I get into any time, you can look at it this way. Any time you experience stress or painful mental state, you did it. And you can undo it. Not the circumstances or the other people. I have the capacity to calm my mind. And you can do it by going for a run or jumping in a pond or whatever. You know, don't be attached to sitting in meditation as the path to get rid of it. It's
right.
Just a clogging of, it's a clogging of energy that needs to be unclogged. And going for a run
right.
is really, or anyway, please take good care of yourself. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
I pray that we get to do this again sometime. I would love to have another conversation with you anytime. And I will, where can people find your book?
Amazon.com.
Amazon, okay. I will have all.
Target.
It's a Target? That's awesome. I will have all the links to, I'm sorry. Sometimes, you know, folks like you leave me stammering a little bit. So thank you for this. I really appreciate it. And what a joy. Thank you. That was Yoshin David Radin. Again, if you want to check him out, you can find him at theIthacaZenCenter.org, or you can order his awesome book. It's on Amazon and everywhere. It's called A Temporary Affair, Tales on Awakening in Zen. A big thank you to our sponsors, and a big thank you to you for listening. We'll be back next week. Hope you have a wonderful whatever or wherever you may be. Amen.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.